Hi, this is Bill Arnold. Missed a show or need me talking to help you sleep tonight? I have several solutions to that situation. Here are the podcasts from the show. You are the best for listening and supporting Faith Radio. And a warm welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. Thank you for joining me today. I know we're going to have a great hour because my friend David Wheaton is already going to be joining us. He's already on the line. He's going to be joining us in just a minute. And I'm going to repeat myself quite a bit between now and the end of the month because I really would love to meet all kinds of listeners in the Fargo area or anywhere nearby. If you want to make a road trip, we're going to be doing the 70th anniversary comedy night that we did in March here at the University of Northwestern. We're going to take it on the road and take it to Bethel Church in Fargo, May 31st. I was just looking over some of the many responses I got from that night, and I got a really nice email from someone that named Karen that came to the show. She said, "My husband and I, along with six other friend couples, attended. We were all just bubbling over how much fun we had, how each performance showcased the talents and gifts of the three, and how we truly laughed and giggled. The whole evening surpassed even our highest expectations." How nice is that? So I promise you're going to have a really great night if you come out. Myself, Bob Stromberg, Michael Pierce Donnelly, we're going to give you a night that you shall not forget. All right, and that's May 31st. Go to myfaithradio.com to grab a ticket or two or 100. Feel free to buy 100. All right, we'll take a 60-second break and then we'll be back with David Wheaton.
Summer is so close you can almost touch it or taste it.
Ice cream.
Or in that case, devour it. You're wired to long for something good. So as you listen to Faith Radio, we hope you develop a healthy longing for the day when all will be made right. It's called hope. And the good news is, we're one day closer than yesterday. How sweet it is. Connecting faith to life, Faith Radio.
There are more ways than ever before to listen to Faith Radio, and the newest is using your Amazon Echo Smart device. If you have an Echo Smart device in your home or office, enable the Faith Radio skill on the Alexa app or with your voice by asking your Amazon Echo to enable Faith Radio. Once you've enabled the skill, just ask your Amazon Echo to play Faith Radio. Listen to the live stream or any Faith Radio podcast hands-free anytime on your Echo Smart device. Find out more at myfaithradio.com.
Welcome back to the show. I seem to be having a lot of my friends on the show today, which I love. It was nice having George Fraser on the show and Wally Colesrud, and now I get to talk to my good pal David Wheaton, host of The Christian Worldview. Go to thechristianworldview.org to learn more about David and his amazing show and the great books he's written. David, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be with you, Bill.
Yeah, so tell me how Friday night went, last Friday night here at the University of Northwestern.
Well, we had a wonderful time. It was a great evening. We had a really nice turnout, but Curtis Bowers, who was the producer of these agenda films, have been very popular, outlining how the worldview of socialism and even communism has impacted our country. Just did a great job, and I really learned a lot that evening because socialism is a word that is kind of thrown around. It's a pejorative word, and it's, you know, some people look at it and say, there's no socialism in this country, and so forth. Well, I think Curtis would be the first one to say, yeah, we're not a socialistic country, of course, but many socialistic policies that we maybe don't identify so easily as socialism are, in fact, the worldview of socialism, which was originated by Karl Marx in his book, The Communist Manifesto. I'll just give you a couple examples, Bill, like universal health care. We hear about that all the time. That is a socialistic policy. Your universal basic income, that everyone deserves to get an income from the government, whether they work or not. Or the environmental policy of the Green New Deal. It's just really an overtaking of the society and every other aspect through the guise of, you know, cleaning up the environment. That also is a socialistic aspect of a worldview of socialism. Government-controlled education, free college, student loan debt forgiveness, elimination of citizen gun rights. the redefinition of biblical family and marriage and morality. You know, we look at these issues, we hear about them in the news. And I think we need to understand that these aren't, in fact, traditional American free market liberty type issues. These are big government issues that are based on the worldview of socialism. And that's really what I learned that particular evening at the event. And I want to thank you for promoting the event. We had just a lot of great listeners come out, and we had a wonderful evening.
That sounds wonderful. And socialism is so attractive to younger people, and they represent a pretty powerful voting bloc. So definitely have to pay attention to all this. But when you throw the word free out, you're going to get a lot of people's attention.
Right. But of course, it's not free. You know, when we say free college, a younger person might think that's great. Well, in order to have that money to pay for your free college, it may be free for you, but you have forcibly taken money from someone else, some income earner, someone who's gone out and worked and earned to take that money from them to redistribute it to you. And I think you're right. That's why it's so attractive, particularly for younger people when they hear about free college and student loan debt forgiveness and universal health care and all these kinds of things, and especially with regards to the moral aspect that is pushed through the left in this country. You know, they're all in favor of this. And so what they don't understand is you cannot have forced equality, which is what socialism seeks to do. It seeks to have a bigger government to force equality in society, whether between the rich and the poor, the majority skin color and minority skin colors or religions, that kind of thing. So it forces equality. So the people, let's say, that are perceived to be oppressed, socialism says, well, what we're going to do is whether you deserve it or earn it or not, we're going to put you up into a different category by, on the other side of the spectrum, taking liberty, taking wages, income away from those people and bringing those people down. So that's what socialism does. You can't have forced equality without taking away people's liberty. And that's what I think is the danger and the deceptive nature of the worldview of socialism that we really have to watch out for, because the Bible does not teach socialism. If a man won't work, neither let him eat. There's a big difference between justice and mercy. Mercy is what you do to people out of compassion and charity. Justice is what people get what they deserve. Forced coercion, or the kind of what we talk about social justice, is really giving something to someone not out of charity. It's giving them out of coercing something out of someone else. That's such an important dynamic to understand, Bill.
David, what does socialism, the mentality of this, do to the value of things? You know, part of the reason you go to college and you do well is because you know in your heart either you're getting out loans to pay for it or your parents have sacrificed to help pay for it. It's worth a lot. Therefore, you put a lot into it. If everything is free, you kind of quit valuing stuff, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, when there's not as much incentive to advance yourself when you are going to be given a trophy, no matter how well you do, or a free college, how well you do, you tend not to value it as much. You haven't had to work and labor for it. And that's why a socialistic worldview leads to more indolence in society, where people are thinking, I deserve something. What's coming to me? What do I have? What are my rights? Instead of thinking in terms of how can I use my God-given abilities to improve myself, to work hard, and then, by the way, to voluntarily help other people and to show compassion to those who don't have as much, rather than the other way around. What do I have coming to me? And people should help me no matter what lifestyle choices I make in my life.
Mm-hmm. Now, shouldn't we be more preoccupied with what are our responsibilities versus our rights?
Very much. You know, I think that Christians should be very careful about ever using sentences like, well, I deserve this, I have a right to that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we have a right. You know, rights, some Christians would say they come from God, and I think God does intend, he would prefer that we have individual liberties like we do in America. But if those rights were guaranteed, then everywhere in the world would have the kind of same kind of freedom we do. So sometimes you have to realize that rights do come from the government under which you live through the laws, even though I think God intends us to have rights. But the problem is when we start to think in terms of, well, I deserve this, I have rights to this, we really don't deserve anything except really judgment by God. Mm-hmm. And so when we start with that mentality that I don't deserve anything, all I deserve is judgment, then when we understand the grace of God that he offers to forgive us through sending his son to die in our place on the cross, that's when we can be incredibly grateful and realize I don't deserve anything, but here's what God did for me. And I think when we apply that to society as well, like we don't really deserve anything, but we have to work hard to improve ourselves, to have incentive to feed our families, to live in a home and so forth, not being given those things, then I think the society works more the way the original American founders intended it to work.
Mm-hmm. David, did your guest on Friday night talk about the difference between socialism and communism?
Yeah, well, basically, socialism is just, socialism is just the transitional step between capitalism, which is more, you know, free market, private property, individual liberties, that kind of thing, market-based, and communism, where government controls everything, like in China, the Soviet Union, Cuba, North Korea. You know, this is where it's just completely oppressive. That's communism, where there's no choice. You must do what the government says. They own and control everything. Socialism is a transitional step to that, and Karl Marx knew that. They realized you can't go from capitalism to communism. People just won't. They'll rebel and they'll revolt. But there's this creeping socialism in this country that is moving that direction. That's why they're trying to accomplish it, like someone like Bernie Sanders or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. They're called democratic socialists. They believe in achieving socialism through evolution, not revolution. And so that's a key thing to understand, is that socialism can happen not at the end of the point of the gun. It can happen through people just getting dependent more and more on government and saying, hey, I like this. I'm going to vote for people who are going to give me things rather than really what's based on what's best for society and how we can improve as people.
Yeah, David, do you know how Venezuela would be classified now?
Well, it's definitely a socialistic state, and it's a failed socialistic state. And by the way, that's really the evidence that all we need against socialism and communism. It has never worked, and right. It's only oppressed people. You'll hear the lie all the time that, you know, religion is the cause of all the most deaths and murders in the world. That is not the case. You look at our last century, the literally over 100 million, I think it was, people were murdered through communist regimes, whether by Lenin, Stalin, Mao, Pol Pot, all these different places, Castro, all these different places around the world that integrated socialism and communism. It always oppresses people because, again, you can't have equality without compromising people's individual liberties. And in communism, it's just done on steroids, so to speak, that people get oppressed. And it never works. It always fails. And yet people think if we just do it a different way, we can achieve this equity that socialism promises. But it never works out.
It's crazy, David. I mean, think communism is responsible for 130 million deaths.
Yeah, that you have the number, but I knew it was somewhere above 100 million, and it is the source. But I think there's a natural bent inside, and this is kind of came out on Friday night as well, too. There's something naturally in the heart of unregenerate mankind that yearns for socialism and for communism because they don't believe in God, and so government has to be God. If we can just get the smart people ordering our society a certain way, then we're going to have utopia on earth. There's going to be peace. There's going to be equity. There's going to be, you know, global cooperation and so forth. But the eerie thing about it, Bill, is that the end of scripture talks about the fact that there's going to be one world leader someday. There's going to be a global type government. And so that's where the world is moving. If I understand Revelation to teach what it's teaching, is that things are moving that way, and you can just feel it, that people want to go that direction. There's like a natural bent of mankind that wants to go that socialistic route. But that's why America has been such an incredible country. It's one of the few countries in the world that hasn't gone down that particular path.
Yeah, David Wheaton is my guest. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, lots more with David. David Wheaton is my guest. He's a regular on the show and longtime friend. And David, I just got a really nice comment from a listener. Said, I'm constantly captivated when David Wheaton's on. Boy, is he smart.
Well, I don't know about that. But I've had a lot of good teachers, and we are a product of our influences. Paying attention to those who, I think especially, teach the Word of God soundly has had such a big impact on my life. So I'm so thankful for those influences in my life.
Yeah, and this listener named Terry threw this in too. He said, when it comes to the current popularity of socialism, a quote from John Wesley comes to mind, what one generation will tolerate, the next generation will embrace.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And I think that's what's worrisome, because we hear about socialism, communism, and think, well, that's back in the 20th century. We're so beyond that. But I think the worldview of socialism is more pervasive in this country in so many different issues. If you just pay attention to it and realize they never identify it by socialism. They never call it universal health care, or even our public education system. You think about it, for public education, you have no choice, from a standpoint of where the government's going to provide education for your child. You only have one choice where they're going to pay for it, and that's in a public school. That is really the definition of socialism, where it's a government from the top, top-down, government-ordered educational system. Now, you can go somewhere else. You can homeschool or private school, but you're going to be paying for that. And so we need to realize that so many policies and so many programs in our country are really undergirded by this worldview of socialism. And to realize that Christians, I think we can get easily sucked into it and thinking it's a good thing when government does these things for us. Or we'll look at scripture and say, Matthew 25, let's do it. Christ said, unless you do it to, when you've done it to the least of these, you've done it to me. Or the early church in Acts 2, they had all things in common. Here's the issue. That wasn't socialism. That was voluntary charity. That was mercy, voluntary compassion, voluntary giving. That's not what we're talking about in society today. It's different. Government comes to you and says, I'm going to take what you have, I'm going to give it to someone else, whether you want me to or not, and whether they deserve it or not. I'm going to cut down the people at the top, even though they don't deserve that. I'm going to bring up people at the bottom, even though they don't deserve that for whatever reason. Now, that being said, Christians should be stepping in, the church should be stepping in to help the least of these. Absolutely. We should be charitable. But it shouldn't come from the top down from government, because that takes away people's individual liberties.
Well, I agree completely. When I think of higher education, though, today, and I think of the secularization of universities, there's going to be a lot of students that are going to be wanting socialism because of what they're learning at college. That's why a Christian education would be so important. However, having said that, a lot of Christian students, they go off to college, and after 4 years, they've lost a bunch of their faith. And I know you wrote about that in your book, University of Destruction. I'd love for you to say more about that.
Yeah, well, that is probably the most troubling thing that takes place, is that people will read my book, University of Destruction, or hear me speak on it or something. Well, I should just send my son or daughter to a Christian college then. Well, the statistics bear out that if you go to a Christian college, a so-called Christian college, that actually a higher percentage of students who go to those college will say they are no longer born-again Christians than if they had gone to a secular university. And you just think, how on earth can that be? Well, the simple explanation to it is that just because something or some organization professes to be Christian doesn't mean it's sound. And so Christian students grow up in homes and have a more, maybe are exposed to more traditional orthodox interpretations of scripture. They go off to these so-called Christian colleges, and what they learn in the classroom from their professors is a really deconstruction of orthodox Christianity. And so they'll say, the Bible isn't truly the word of God, is not really inspired. That's sort of not really what it means. Or the miracles aren't real. Christ didn't really, they're more metaphorical and to teach us, life lessons. There's a liberalizing of the way the Bible is interpreted. And so when students encounter that, they're hearing words like Bible and Jesus and some of the same stories and principles they heard growing up, but interpreted in a totally different way. And so they become more confused than ever. And it's really a false gospel. It's false teaching. And so after 4 years, if they've been exposed to that, they go away from college saying, you know what? I don't believe any more of the way I was raised in my home or in my church. And then they're one of the statistics that loses their faith while they're in college.
Mm-hmm. David, maybe you would touch on what you call the three pillars of peril.
Yeah, well, those basically, if you want to summarize everything that a Christian college student will encounter in college, as far as temptation, it's going to be is one of these three categories. There's a battle for the body, which is sexual immorality. There's a battle for the spirit, or drugs and alcohol. And the battle for the spirit comes from, you know, Acts chapter 5, I think it's 18. Don't be drunk with wine, but be filled with the spirit. In other words, you're either filled with the Holy Spirit as a Christian, or you're filled with alcoholic spirits. You can't be filled with both. And then there's finally a battle for the mind, which is what we've been talking about in the first segment, about the worldview of humanism, or I guess you could say socialism. They're really almost one and the same. It's man-based thought rather than Bible or God-based thought. So that worldview they encounter in the classroom really just completely evangelizes them, to use a Christian word, away from biblical Christianity. So whether what they face in the classroom of humanism, that third pillar of peril, or whether what they face in the dorm room of the first two, sexual immorality and drugs and alcohol, there's more than that. But those three, I think, really encapsulate what every Christian student was going to face, and whether they go to a secular campus or even some Christian college campuses.
Well, what about the poor kid that just wants to fit in and make some friends, and he's got some social anxiety, and all of a sudden he finds himself agreeing with certain groups of people just to make friends?
Well, that peers are critical in school. And I think, I've heard this, and I wrote this book partly because this happened to me when I went to Stanford. The first I was there, I was not grounded at all in my faith. I'm not even sure I was truly saved when I went to college. You get in with some of the wrong friends. You're looking for acceptance. You're looking to kind of fit in. And things can go wrong very quickly. A lot of you talk to ministries on campus, and they'll see, professing Christian students come in within the first couple of weeks. They're already going astray because it's such a huge transition to go to college. I think it's one of the most difficult transitions anyone faces in their life. You think about it, Bill. You grow up in your parents' home. Mm-hmm. You're kind of basing your life on your parental values. You're dependent on them. And all of a sudden, you're 18 years old. Whether you're ready or not, you're thrust out. You go to this period of going from forming your own your parental values to forming your own personal values. You go from dependence to independence, all in a very short period of time, whether you're really ready for it or not. And too many students are not ready for this. And you're around only uniform age peer group, something you never encounter at another time in your life. You're being told certain different worldview from your professors. Usually college kids, Christian college kids, aren't involved in a church. The parents are away. So just think about that. Put all that together, and what do you think is going to happen when you go off to college, unfortunately? Yeah. Now, that being said, let me give just one little bit of good news. It doesn't have to be that way. As many as 50% of Christian students will say they are no longer born-again Christians if they've been in college for 4 years. But you know what? There's another 50% that actually can do pretty well in college if they're grounded in the Word, if they have what I call a strong spiritual GPA. It's how well they interact with God, their peers, and their authorities. If they do those three relationships really well, mm-hmm. they can go anywhere to college. And they're not only just going to be able to survive college, but they're going to be able to thrive. They're going to be able to impact their classmates. And it's going to be a very positive experience. So while there are dangers, it doesn't have to be the university of destruction. It can be a university for instruction.
David, thank you so much for doing the show. I think the only time... I think growing up in high school was the only time we liked socialism.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Then you have to live on your own.
Right. David Wheaton's been my guest. Go to thechristianworldview.org. Thanks, David. Have a great day. We'll be back in just a minute.
You too, Bill.
Thanks.
Network.org.
I am so glad to be welcoming back to the show A.J. Swoboda. I loved his name when I first heard it, and I thought he's either a relief pitcher for the Mets or he's a really smart theologian. And it turns out that the second was correct. And he's written a book called The Surprising Power of Rest in a Nonstop World. Subversive Sabbath is what he calls it. And he's also written another book, too, that I'm going to try to get to in this conversation I'm having with him today. It's called Redeeming How We Talk. But let's do one at a time. Let's start by welcoming AJ back to the show. Hi, AJ.
Oh, Bill, it's great to be with you. And I should clarify, a rumor on the street is I'm actually related to Ron Swoboda of the Mets.
That's so cool.
Oh, might be true.
Oh, let's stop this interview right now. I have all the information I need.
Yes, there you go.
So as we live in a endless cycle of work, distraction, burnout, anxiety, pressure, all of this. Has there ever been a more important time to be understanding what God is trying to teach us about the Sabbath rest?
Well, I've kind of been on a bit of a crusade recently to argue that, no, there's no more important time. In fact, as we increasingly see burnout rates among pastors, even suicide rates among teenagers and whatnot, I think it's all connected to the same issue, and that is that we have forgotten the one command in the Bible that God actually asked us to remember, which was the fourth commandment, remember the Sabbath, and to do it in the way Jesus did it, in a very graceful, loving way. But in a world of burnout, I don't know if there is a more important topic for the church to really be capturing today.
Mm-hmm. Mark 2:27, of course, you know this, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So God obviously has something very specifically designed for its purpose, and we need to be reminded of what it is and then live it out.
Yeah, it's a gift. In fact, for those of us who have been practicing the Sabbath for some time, or even in the Jewish tradition, the Sabbath was understood primarily as a gift from God. It was given to us, not us to the Sabbath. Of course, we're doing the Sabbath inappropriately when we become enslaved to it. It's not a new form of slavery that we legalistically seek to do perfectly. Rather, it's a gift, a very gift from God. And gifts are very hard to receive, particularly for work-oriented people. But it is a gift, and when we begin to do it, it is profoundly life-changing.
AJ, you suggest in your book that God may actually do more when we do less. A little counterintuitive, but I love it. Please say more.
Well, yeah, I mean, the irony of the Bible is that, you know, God created Adam and Eve on day six, and then day seven told them to rest. And when you look at the context for rest for Adam and Eve, you know, we generally as Americans think we get to rest after we've gotten all of our work done. The biblical story actually gives us a completely opposite story, that Adam and Eve's very first day of existence, day seven after their creation, was a day of rest. And that they had done absolutely nothing to earn it. It was, in my opinion, the first image of the gospel, which was God's nature is to give us rest, give us love, give us peace before we've ever earned it. Yeah, we need to get to work afterwards, but we begin with rest and then get to work later on. So the whole narrative of rest is that it is primarily a gift given for people who've gotten nothing done.
Mm-hmm. AJ, is this about a certain day of the week, or is it a position of the heart? What does observing the Sabbath look like for believers today?
Yeah, well, there are some really important New Testament texts that clarify that question, particularly the what day does it need to be. Paul, for example, writes, you know, some people think one day is sacred and other people think another day is sacred, but whatever you do it unto the Lord. And then in 2 Corinthians, he says, you know, don't let anybody judge you because of what day the Sabbath is. And what I read when I read that is that Paul is freeing us from any kind of legalistic command that says it needs to be a certain day, and is actually inviting us to have a grace-filled Sabbath. And so, you know, I'll tell you this. If it has to be Sunday, I'm a pastor. If it has to be Sunday, I'm toast. Because there has never been a day in human history where a pastor has walked away from church on Sunday and said, that was a refreshing experience. It's hard work.
Right.
And there needs to be a grace. There needs to be a Sabbath for me, and it can't be Sunday. So I don't believe the day matters. What I believe matters is one in seven, that one day in seven is the day, is the invitation.
Yeah. Well, work and lack of rest and health and exercise and everything else leads us to an early death. Talk about Sabbath and health.
Mm-hmm.
Just to be practical.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, even there's some really fascinating research around this, because many Seventh-day Adventist friends, who I'm grateful for, but I have long believed that their position on the Sabbath has been unnecessarily burdensome, arguing that it has to be on Saturday. Even Seventh-day Adventists who do the Sabbath, in my opinion, a bit legalistically, even though they do it legalistically, the implications and the ramifications of their practice of the Sabbath are incredible. The average Seventh-day Adventist lives 10 years longer than the average American.
Wow.
So even when we do the Sabbath legalistically, it blesses us. Even when it's done improperly, it blesses us. And so I would say, if you don't want to follow the Sabbath because God told you to do it, well, then just do it because you want an extra 10 years of life. And you'll have it. I mean, it literally will make you a healthier human being.
Wow.
Now, the danger is we don't obey God for just for the byproducts. We obey God because God said to do it, and we obey God. But it turns out when you obey God, there usually are pretty awesome ramifications.
AJ, we live obviously in a world where being productive is an idol. We always have to be productive. Are we going to be productive today? You hear that all the time. So the idea of resting, does that mean we're going to be not productive? Because that's really going to be hard for a lot of people.
The opposite. Yes. So studies are revealing that our productivity has a threshold.
Okay.
So if we work 7 days a week, our productivity actually goes down. Studies have been done and shown that if you work 5 to 6 days a week, your productivity goes up. So the idea, I actually go back to 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, I believe it is, where Paul talks about this concept of idleness. And idleness is being a busybody. It's doing too much. And he invites the church to settle down and earn the food that they eat. I think that we overproduce, and our productivity actually in the end goes down. Incidentally, when I preached on the Sabbath in our church for 3 weeks, I preached on all sorts of things that have made people mad. I preached on sexuality, which I'm very conservative on sexuality. I've preached on marijuana. I've preached on open marriages. I've preached on a lot of things that have made people mad in our church. And I preached on the Sabbath for 3 weeks, and I don't think we've ever had more people leave our church. And incidentally, when the elders wanted to sit down and talk about this concept of the Sabbath, I had an epiphany that really has kind of haunted me, that as a pastor, if I broke 9 of the commandments, if I stole money from the church, I'd lose my job. If I started preaching another name of God, I'd lose my job. If I murdered somebody, I'd definitely lose my job. And it dawned on me for the first time that if I don't keep the Sabbath as a pastor, I'll probably get a raise. It has literally become the one commandment that we incentivize people breaking.
I'm a little stunned right now. I'm trying to figure out why people were leaving in your church when you're teaching about Sabbath. I would think that would be the most welcome message out there, because you'd be giving permission to people to rest.
It turns out that the Sabbath completely steps on and offends all of our modern idols, our sensibilities around productivity, affluence, work, wealth. It disrespects all of those idols and actually calls us to turn from the gods of wealth, the gods of productivity, the gods of Egypt, and says, turn to the Lord your God, Yahweh, and worship him and him alone. Because we are not the culmination of our productivity. We are made in the image of God and made for him and him alone.
So, AJ, am I thinking this clearly, that if we are taking a Sabbath rest, is there a chance that this rest we're taking is going to be pleasing to God?
Yes, we got to be careful with this, because at no point can we say that in keeping the law, God is more pleased with us. God is pleased with us because of Christ.
Okay.
Is the fulfillment of the law. And the danger is for a lot of Christians is they think if I start keeping a Sabbath, God likes me more.
I wasn't thinking that. I was wondering, is it pleasing to God to have
100%.
See his, okay.
He made us for this. It is displeasing to God when I kill or murder a human being.
Yes.
It is displeasing to God when I choose to worship money over God. And it is displeasing to God when I do not honor my body and time the way that God asked me to.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, 100%, God is pleased when any of us seek to live according to the way God asked us to live.
Mm-hmm. Part one of
but we are not saved by keeping a Sabbath.
No.
The same way that we're not saved by being baptized. We are saved by Jesus and Jesus alone.
Of course. Amen to all that. I was just really wondering that if God is pleased with our purposeful work that we do, if he would also be pleased with the fact that we are taking a Sabbath rest.
Yes. And incidentally, I should say, in Exodus 20, the fourth commandment, The invitation to rest is simultaneously an invitation to work. Rest 1 day a week and work 6 days a week. So this is actually an invitation also to work really well. It is both. It is not just an invitation to rest. It is simultaneously an invitation to work really hard.
Okay, AJ, I got a whole bunch of questions still coming your way. I'm going to take a break in a couple of minutes, but I want you to tackle this question before the break. If we need to start creating what you know, this Sabbath rest in our lives, and right now let's say it doesn't exist, where do we start?
You start right where you are, and you begin with what God has given to you. And I know people, for example, when I preached for 3 weeks on this, there were moms in the room who took it really hard. It was very hard for moms. I would say if you have a half a day and you can start with that, I say give God that half a day and he will meet you. My gut tells me that if you do half a day, you're going to love it so much you'll start fighting for a whole day.
Uh-huh. I think you're absolutely right.
You start with what you've got and move from there.
Okay. Let me take a little break. My guest is A.J. Swoboda. He's written a book called Subversive Sabbath, The Surprising Power of Rest in a Nonstop World. Be back in 90 seconds. To the show, I have on my guest line AJ Swoboda. He's written a book called Subversive Sabbath, and we're talking about the Sabbath rest, a very important subject. I know a lot of us feel completely burned out. Maybe you've become irritable, maybe you don't sleep that good at night, and then you're irritable that you don't sleep, and then you're not productive during the day, and you think you got to do more, and maybe you have to do less, and maybe God will recalibrate once you start taking this Sabbath rest. I'm very fascinated, AJ, because we all live in these times of there's so much on the calendar. Every time you get a break, you think, if I had an afternoon off, I really should call up that neighbor friend of mine that I've been saying for 6 months I'll take him out for coffee, and I haven't done it yet. How do you shut that voice off in your head?
Well, I would never invite anybody to shut down the voice that says be a good neighbor and love the people around you. But I would say hear that voice and then do the hard work of scheduling in a way that honors your rest. Eugene Peterson wrote once in a book, the late Eugene Peterson, who has had a huge impact on my life. He made a comment years ago that the root sin of burnout is actually laziness. And his point was that when you burn out, it's largely because you were so lazy that you couldn't have the fortitude and strength to say no to people. Mm. So at the end of the day, it's a laziness of spirit that leads to burnout. At the end of the day, God wants us to be strong in our spirit to be able to hear his voice and honor what he's invited us to do. So I would say listen to that voice and then schedule it for one of the days that you're not resting.
Mm-hmm. In part two of your book, you talk about Sabbath for others, and you talk about Sabbath economy and technology. That is very interesting. Explain more about that.
Well, this is one of those parts of the Bible that actually affects, I mean, the Bible affects everything, but this is one of those commandments in the Bible that at the end of the day is so practical in its relationship to the real world. I mean, this affects the way that we live in the economy that we've been placed in, which incidentally was why Pharaoh hated the Sabbath so much and wouldn't let the Jews rest, because had they rested, it would have affected his bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
The Jews actually, people loved, interestingly enough, people loved going to war with the Jews in the ancient world. They loved going to war with the Jews because the Jews were the only people group in the world that would not fight 1 day a week. So if you were fighting against the Jews, you would get a day off as their enemies. It affects the bottom line of everything. And then on technology, what if we took a day a week and turned our phones off? Now, I know immediately the minute we turn our phones off, our fingers are trembling and we're terrified. And even that moment, you know, when we turn it off, it's interesting that the people who made the Bible or made the iPhones did it in such a way that when you turn your iPhone off, it flashes an apple with a bite taken out of it, like we're back in the Garden of Eden. Wow. And we've been eating from the wrong tree all week long. But even that moment of turning the phone off, it is so – that goes so against our culture. I mean, it offends every modern sensibility that one day a week I'm not at your service. I am – for one day a week, I am before the Lord my God. I'm with my family. I'm eating pancakes. That affects real stuff. And I think the point of the second part of my book really is – second, third part – is to nail down the idea – that when we do the Sabbath, it really does actually reorient our relationship to the world. And at the end, it actually becomes an opportunity to witness to who Jesus is.
Mm. That's powerful. Really, really good. Say more about discipleship and how a Sabbath and discipleship work together. Because, you know, you've encouraged me to be thoughtful and loving towards my neighbor. And discipleship is 24/7 in my head. It never goes away.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I think what I really need to do is take 4 days and drive up north and look at Lake Superior and eat and sleep and read a book and go for a walk and eat a good meal and just come back. And there's pressure. I even feel pressure in my head that I might not come back feeling the refreshment I so long for. Mm. Isn't that crazy?
I'm going to guess every one of your listeners has the odd experience of actually coming back from a vacation more tired than when they left.
True.
And that's because a vacation and a Sabbath are not the same thing. A vacation usually is not actually being present to God. And usually it's just being running through Disneyland and catching up with your kids. In terms of discipleship, I mean, at the end of the day, the idea of the Sabbath is very scary. I've always thought of Moses going up on the mountain. When Moses goes up on the mountain to receive the law and he comes back down after Israel has been brought out of Egypt, and he comes back down the mountain and all of God's people are worshiping a golden calf. That story epitomizes for me why we're terrified of rest. Or I should say, why pastors don't take a Sabbath. Or why we don't – because – we're terrified. You know, if I go up the mountain and come back down, all of God's people are worshiping a golden calf. I'm going to figure out I'm a bad leader. But the real thing, the real fear, this is the crux of the matter, is if we go up the mountain and come back down and everybody's still worshiping God and we realize we're not near as important as we thought we were.
Uh-huh.
I think what the Sabbath actually does is it displaces us from our self-centeredness and actually centers us back on Christ. It is the ultimate act of discipleship, of saying to the world and to yourself, Jesus Christ is Lord and I am not. It is so rooted in being a disciple of Jesus and displacing us even from ourselves onto Christ. Young people tell me all the time, Gen Zers, millennials, of which I'm kind of an older millennial, they're always saying to me, I don't hear God's voice. I don't hear his voice. I don't hear his voice. Well, when you spend on average 7 hours a day in front of your iPhone, no wonder we don't hear God's voice. We're not giving him any space to speak. But it turns out when you take a day and you're unavailable, God starts getting really loud.
Hmm. You know, I've got a couple of minutes left, AJ, and I would love to hear, and this might be too personal, so I apologize in advance, would you walk me through a day in your life of a Sabbath?
Yeah. Well, luckily I've written on this, so it's a public info. But
okay, good.
So the evening before the Sabbath, which our family Sabbath is on Tuesdays, Monday evening I come home and we sing a song, the Sabbath Shabbat Shalom, and we do family devotions together. We read from the Gospels, and then we do communion together. And we sing a couple worship songs. And then that evening we go to bed. And in the morning we wake up and we make the biggest pancake feast you've ever had.
Yum.
And
I want your recipe.
Yes. Well, my son is 7. It is the liturgy for my son. I mean, he if you ask my son, what is the Sabbath about? He would say it's about pancakes.
Yeah.
And the reason we do the pancakes is in the ancient world, there's an old ancient tradition that says that on the morning of the Sabbath, the father was to get up before any of the kids and get each kid a spoon of honey.
Oh, wow.
So that the children would never forget the sweetness of God's rest. And we don't do honey, we do maple syrup. And the goal is that in 50 years when I'm dead and gone, my son, if anybody even says the word Sabbath around him, just starts to drool.
Because he
remembers God's rest. And what we do on the Sabbath, we eat good food, we go on hikes, we go on walks, we read our Bible, we read books, we watch a movie, we hang out with our neighbors if they want, our family, our phones are off. We're present to God, and we're present to each other.
Now you're making me weepy.
It's powerful. And the truth is, Bill, we've been doing this now for about 15 years.
Wow.
And we've never done Sabbath perfectly. But I will say this, every time we've done the Sabbath, it is like we're back in the Garden of Eden.
That's fantastic.
Beautiful.
So do you have a nice flat griddle that you put these cakes on? I'm just trying to figure out what I got to buy to make myself happier.
A cast iron griddle.
Nice.
The best pancake mix that I've ever found is called Snoqualmie pancake mix, and we use that among others. And I will tell you, pancakes have changed my son's life.
I'm not surprised.
They've changed my life.
I'm not surprised. Yep. If I were him, I would get his middle name changed to Pancake.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay, AJ, I had all these grandiose plans to cover a couple of books that you have, and I only got through one, so... You know what that means? I need to have you back, and the sooner the better, because I want to cover your other book, Redeeming How We Talk, Discover How Communication Fuels Our Growth, Shapes Our Relationship, and Changes Our Lives. That's a topic I want to discuss, so maybe you will accept an invitation to come back soon.
I'd love it. Bill, thanks for having me, and thanks for listening.
Yep. Dr. A.J. Swoboda has been my guest, professor, author, and pastor of Theophilus Church in Portland. We'll take a short break, and we'll be right back with lots more.
Hi, I'm Ted Ross with the Faith in Life Minute. Many people go to work every day miserable, longing for a different job. Robert Dickey is the president of Crown Financial, and he's written the book, The Leap, Launching Your Full-Time Career in Our Part-Time Economy.
God opens doors. He presents opportunities and blessings. And I just think this is so important for us not to be so self-consumed. And that's kind of like the natural tendency, I believe, in our society. And as Christians, you know, we're called to serve the poor, to help the widow, to help those in need. And so that's why I think it's so important for us to try to build financial margin and time margin in our lives so that we can be focused on others, helping people in our churches and in our communities. And I have seen it time and time again that God blesses that, not only from a spiritual sense, but also opportunities seem to just come out of those experiences.
Hear more from Robert Dickey and find links to his book at myfaithradio.com.
It's encouragement and hope for your daily journey. Faith Radio.
It brings a balance into my wife's and my lives that other people, unfortunately, are missing. So we like to share with others and tell them to get in there and listen to something good for a change.
We're connecting faith and life together. Faith Radio.
Thanks to all my guests for coming on to the show. It has been a great day. I hope you've enjoyed. If you missed any of today, go to myfaithradio.com and make sure you get your tickets for the comedy night in Fargo on May 31st. Have a great night, everyone. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.